News Report for the week of December 11th, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
Where the snark game is savage, the clapback is on fleek, we are fully woke, and Brian, we are ready to get turned up.
Brian, I don't know where you're getting this stuff from, Brian. Do you seriously like think about this all week long, like what you're going to say next?
I don't know how to describe it. This is the highlight of my week, and this is one of those where I was thinking about it going, how many phrases can I throw in there that's going to really mess you up and have you saying, I don't even understand. Are you speaking English? What does that even mean?
WTH, right?
Yes, there you go.
I gotta say, Brad, it's kind of sad that this is the highlight of your week, though. Can I say that?
There's not much going on in my life right now. How's that?
So listen, our guest for today's show is the one and only Fiona Givens. We're going to be chatting with her about her new book, The Christ Who Heals, How God Restored the Truths That Save Us. This is published by Deseret Book. But before we get to that, we're doing video.
Here we are.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least for this portion of it anyway. So we'll talk a little bit about what we're doing with the video. But first, before we go into the news this week, we've got some feedback from our question last week that we threw out that we should get to. And of course, we've got tons of articles to discuss this week.
Brian, it's almost become like a broken record at this point. It's going to be an easy week. Oh, wait, no, it's not. It's going to be a really packed week, and everyone better buckle in. But before we start digging into that, there is one small piece of administrative stuff that we need to take care of. We talked back in October about the Katie Snyder Evans Memorial Fund, and we advised everybody that if you donated to our Patreon, that all the funds that we received from the month of October would go to the Katie Snyder Evans Fund. Well, I finally had 2 extra minutes in my day to take care of everything. We made a donation of $27 to the Katie Snyder Evans Memorial Fund. We're going to include a copy of the receipt of that in the show notes, but we want to thank all of you, our loyal supporters, for thanking you. We would like to thank you for doing that, because it really meant a lot. Brian, you and I both had known Katie through different online interactions, and it was just a tragic story. And we're really proud to see all of our listeners come out in full force and really help out everything that they're doing.
So what we're planning to do with the video, and we'll talk more later about this, but we're planning on putting at least the news portion of the videos each week up on Patreon, up on Facebook, up on YouTube, because everybody needs to see Brant's basement.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Everybody needs to know that Brant lives under the stairs. It's kind of a Harry Potter thing.
Yep.
And everybody needs to see my, on fleek toy collection.
Your Funko Pops back there are making me very jealous, Brian. How's that?
and I'm representing Star Wars, right? Because we've got the next installment coming out at the end of this week, Brant. I'm excited for that.
It's believe me, I have been, this is something my wife doesn't get into this too much, but that's all I've been hearing for the last month is, Brant, you've got our tickets, right? You've got our tickets. And I had to tell her today I don't have the tickets yet. So I'm tickets this week.
So should we jump into last week's question?
Oh, let's do it. So last week's question, we had the founders from Mormon Leaks on, and there have been a couple of stories going on recently about them. We got a lot of feedback about them coming on. And the question is this. Are the group Mormon Leaks helping the church to become more transparent, or are they just tossing gas on a fire? And that is an intentional play of words. But Brian, it's something that you and I, even privately, have been discussing back and forth. Would we want them to be involved in the show at some point? Do we want to give them some airtime? How do we want to interact with a lot of the things that we're doing? Because even though I would say personally, they are very nice dudes. We've been talking with them all week, it feels like. But at the same time, we have some philosophical differences. And so we don't know how to react to some of that. And we didn't know if it was just us or if it was other people who were having some of these same thoughts about them as well. So we threw this out there. And Brian, we got a fair amount of feedback, didn't we?
We got a lot of feedback. So we're going to kind of power through this and then maybe save our commentary towards the end. How's that?
Let's do it.
All right. So let's start off with Brittany Hartley. She said, I wonder if the presence of WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks is, by the way, is Mormon Leaks wiki page where they put all their stuff up.
I thought WikiLeaks was the Julian Assange organization.
Oh, is that the Julian Assange? That's right. They have a Mormon WikiLeaks specific to this. You're right. I wonder if the presence of WikiLeaks will have the opposite effect to transparency. I wonder if having a watchdog will only force leadership to make decisions in a bunker where it's safe in order to hide from the people that unanimous does not always mean everyone was on the same page.
Nick Gallietti said what they are doing is illegal and certainly not a work of honor. Transparency is not always a high ideal. People and private organizations have a right to privacy. It is not the power of authority of some random website to take upon themselves the distribution of those rights as they see fit. Isn't it ironic that a site that promotes transparency takes in its information anonymously or secretively? It is hypocrisy and wrong, whether done to the church, the government, or a private individual, to steal and then profit thereby, even if the profit is masked as social currency.
Carl John Martin said, it is not simply document release, which is in fact not their duty or right to make. It is the selection of which documents to release and those which they'll highlight that prevents the picture they intend. They likely don't have all the documents related to a given issue and highlight those which they do to shape a narrative. They're writing a story, in other words, with an editorial process that makes their point, veiled as a simple exposition. It is rather creative in substance, or so it appears from the cheap seats.
Chad Frankham said, to me, they seem to poke the bear more than being constructive or helpful.
And Austin Beeson, hopefully I'm not butchering your name, Austin, said, while it certainly is true that Mormon leaks will filter through the documents given to them and highlight the leaks that fit their agenda, that doesn't change the need for there to be a channel open for individuals to report things that they see or hear that run contrary to their moral compass. It's too bad that people don't feel comfortable bringing up these issues with their leaders, or these issues are falling on deaf ears. Mormon Leaks is probably more so pouring gasoline on the fire, but I think that they highlight a key problem. People are afraid of voicing open disagreement, even for good reasons at times.
And there's more. Michael Wilcox said, I'm so tired of all news organizations stretching for a story when it isn't there. It goes for both sides. The Deseret News, LDS Living, and others do way too much puff and clickbait, stuff. On the other side, you have local Utah news like the Tribune and KUTV looking for a negative angle to expose the church in search of clicks. Both are shameful and a waste of everyone's time.
And Craig Stapley wrote, I personally don't see change happening in a vacuum. The most well-intentioned, though left unspoken, doesn't count for much. I think the church adapts and changes just like any institution when there is an application of pressure. The leaks are but one voice. They are effective at drawing out the conversation and dialogue, as evidenced with this and this post and others.
Adam Ellsworth said, I haven't noticed any change in the church's transparency as a result of Mormon Leaks. Mormon Leaks increases transparency a little bit against the church's will by showing things that were not previously public, but I have not found the leaks I have seen to read or read very enlightening.
And then Donnie Pack wrote, if the church provided a safe and open means of inquiry, there wouldn't be a need for more controversial communication methods like Mormon Leaks. A fear-based system doesn't allow dialogue.
And Brian, we had a couple from Twitter. The first one, Rosenby at Chunka Monkey says, they aren't helping the church to become more transparent, but I think they're helping young people to get a better idea of what is really happening. Additionally, Danny Berger at Danny Berger 12 writes, replying to the rant on Mormon Leaks, negativity is contagious. That's what they're about. And they make harsh claims and judgments without knowing or disclosing all the facts. They want the church to be transparent when they aren't. So Brian, wow, we've got a lot of hot takes on this. And I got to know, where are you standing? Because it seems like we're all over the board here.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I just want to say to everybody who took the time to write in, to make a comment, or to email us, we really appreciate it. I think that everybody's given some pretty articulate words to what their ideas are behind this. There was nothing in there that I thought was just being bombastic for the sake of being bombastic. You know, some things I agreed with more than others, but here's the deal, Brant. As you mentioned earlier, you know, we have been talking with them and just trying to sort things out. You know, and I kind of I went off on him last week's show, wouldn't you say?
That's an understatement. Okay.
So what I'm about to say is probably going to come as a surprise to some, and those who have already been skeptical of my loyalty to the church institution, this will probably give you even more reason to be skeptical of me. But I'm actually going to say something nice and hopefully rational about the Mormon Leaks guys.
Hold on. I don't even know if I'm ready for this yet, Brian. So, All right. You go with your rationality and all that stuff. Let's see what you got.
So let's think about this for a second. We've had a couple of really important stories breaking over the past couple of years that have done awareness, and maybe even policy changing in some areas. And the two stories that I'm thinking of right now is, number one, the BYU story that the Salt Lake Tribune won the Pulitzer Prize for. Do you remember that story, Brant?
Oh, yeah. Yep. That was the one that made huge, huge news. It, Brian, if I remember, it was a story about those who were going to the honor code off, I'm sorry, those who were going to their ecclesiastical leaders to confess sexual sins or even sexual, not even sexual sins, but it was more instances of sexual assault where they
felt sexual assault. That was the key.
And that's a big difference. It's sexual assault to an ecclesiastical leader. And some of those leaders were in turn reporting that information to the honor code office.
Yeah. So what you think would be clergy privilege was ended up harming their ability to remain students in good standing at BYU. Right. And so there was a bit of victim blaming going on here. Not a bit, a lot. And because this story broke, and because Peggy Fletcher Stack and the Salt Lake Tribune did such a good job of investigative reporting on this, it not only changed the course of BYU and changed their policies for the better, but also affected other universities, particularly around the area. I know Utah State University changed its policies, and other universities have started looking into the issue. So there is a time when I say, you know, that this news that broke, and it was, you know, through leaking documents, it was through people coming out of the woodworks, made a change for the positive.
That's a fair point.
The second story I'm going to bring up is the November 5th policy. Mm-hmm. Now, the November 5th policy has affected a lot of people, a lot of people that you and I both know, Brant. I've had close family members that have dropped out of the church over it. I've seen people, you know, personally affected by this. It's been something that's been very hard for me to watch. Now, when the November 5th policy was first unrolled, it wasn't unrolled with a public press release from the church public relations department to media outlets or to its members. It was backdoored into the church handbook of instructions for bishops. Am I right?
Yep. And I believe that we all found out about it because someone took screenshots and put it on the ex-Mormon subreddit.
Right. And yep. So then you have an organization like Mormon Leaks who verified the accuracy of the information, found out that it was, and then the press started picking up on it, right? So I'm not going to give Mormon Leaks all of the credit for breaking the news in that story, but they did participate in that. And that's a policy that affects a lot of people, a lot of members of the church. And so it's one of those things that you would think we should know about. It should have been something that was publicly announced to the church. And you know, the reason that it wasn't was because they knew that there was going to be a wild storm of backlash, which there was. Mm-hmm. But it looked worse when it was backdoored in and then released through a leak. Am I right?
You're right. And Brian, I think we're two sides of the same coin, but I think we might be almost equidistant apart. I'm with you, and I'm at a point where I really think that the more transparency, the better. Mostly because that's just the way that we're going right now. In our entire world and culture, people are striving for authenticity. Are you telling me what I want to hear, or are you telling me what is actually going on? And so I think when you start including a little bit of the LDS church in that as well, there are some areas where we should be extremely transparent. And there are some areas where I think a modicum of privacy is there. Now, I will say this. I think sometimes the LDS church, as a very, very conservative religion and a group of very conservative individuals, sometimes they fault on the way too conservative side. But I think that what Mormon Leaks does, while I don't particularly agree with a lot of their methodology, and I don't particularly agree with some of the vetting processes and the selection processes that they go through, you can't deny that what is happening with them is, in essence, they're kicking the LDS church into the 2017, and sometimes it's kicking and streaming.
Go ahead.
But I don't know if I wish it would be a little different. I don't like the fact that we have to go down this road to be able to get some of this stuff out there. I think that's my big thing with all this. It's like there's a part of me that says I wish that we didn't have to have a group like Mormon Leaks that was receiving this information from various individuals on various topics and whatever, and releasing it in whatever methodology and way that they're releasing it. But at the same time, man, without them, and Brian, I know from your perspective, we've discussed the historical significance of this. What do you do from a historian's perspective when you have things like this that are leaked out, and some of it legitimately has some historical value? And if you're talking about doing a scholarly type book referencing some of these things, it makes it tough. And I know that I think you've mentioned that usually in situations like this, scholars will try and reference news articles versus the institutions. Is that right?
Yeah, usually because it's something that other people can find.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me parse out what you just said there, because I think that's an important key here is the vetting process, the overall vetting process, because there's areas where, you know, I mean, I know that I'm giving Mormon Leaks a bit of a hug right now and saying, hey, look, you guys do a service. But on the other hand, I also think that if I were them, I would probably be a lot more discriminating in the stuff that I put out. And what I'm referring to, and they know this too, this is what I told them. What I'm referring to is things that are ecclesiastical abuse in nature, certainly sexual assault, things that are policies that are going to affect negatively a large percentage of the membership, things that can harm. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I think that that's where the focus and the energy needs to go. And, you know, Brant, I'm all for a free press and open media and freedom of speech.
Yep.
Right. I'm all for calling people out when they do stupid stuff, particularly when it's institutional abuse. Right. Yep. And now as an active Latter-day Saint and as somebody who considers myself to be loyal to the institution, it pains me to think of my institution as having the possibility of doing harm to people. Right. I genuinely want to believe that the institution that I belong to does good overall for people. And I think it does. I think that by and large, the institution does good more than harm. Mm-hmm. However, I'm not naive enough to think that everything is always on the up and up, to think that there isn't any danger, to think there isn't any possible harm that can be done to members or, you know, or otherwise. And so it's kind of one of those trust but verify things.
Which right? Isn't a bad thing. I really don't think it's a bad thing.
So at any rate, so that's where I'm sitting. If I was them, I would probably be a lot more discriminating with what I put out, looking for things that are specifically harmful to the general membership or to other groups. And, you know, it could be financial, it could be sexual, it could be whatever it is. And the reason for that is because I think that otherwise, when you don't have a vetting process and when you put everything out there that you receive anonymously, I think that it becomes a boy who cries wolf to some extent, right? Now, here's the other side of this, because I know so we have a different philosophy than them. They say, no, we're not going to vet. That's up to, you know, we're not going to discriminate against the information that's given to us. We're just making it available and it's up to the press or whoever to go in and investigate it and research it and to create a story off of it. But you and I both know, Brant, that the media is looking for clicks, that they're looking, that they're going to spin.
Yep.
They're going to look for the hottest take on the story so that they can get the clicks to their website. So that means that anything they put out that's fairly innocuous, and this is what I complained about last week, was this story about BYU and its application acceptance process.
Yep. That's the right one that was giving males. They graded them on a point system and they gave males one extra point.
Right.
The document that had that
information. Yeah. During a time when they were trying to equalize the male to female population. And then when you dig into this kind of stuff, you realize that universities oftentimes play with their algorithms like this to try to equalize their student populations. So it was one of those things that's like, it's really not that big of a deal, right? Like, you know, at least it's something that BYU doesn't need to be singled out on. If that makes sense. So, and I think they would agree with that. They're like, yeah, it's not, I mean, you know, we put it out there. We didn't think it was going to get much traction, but we put it out there because that's what we do. And we'd been, you know, dragging our feet on putting that document out there because we didn't think it had a lot of meat behind it. Right. Now they did admit that there are times when they do target something based on, you know, like when Trump came into town and they said, you know, we're going to go ahead and put out the document about his parents being, you know, baptized in the temples, right? So they targeted that for when he came into town.
And spoiler alert, that's a story that we're going to talk about a little bit later.
Yeah. But I think that the, you know, overall, the philosophy that they have of just putting everything out there, my concern with that is that it's feeding the beast of the media. And the media is going to go in, they're going to grab whatever source. And I know, and I did ask them how, you know, I mean, there are some times when they submit to the press and say, hey, you know, like three or four or five press people that are on their list, they'll say, hey, you know, here's an interesting story you might want to run with. Other times, the press is just following their website. Now, here's what I would ask our listeners to do, to hold them accountable. They have a website, and I know you probably don't want to give it clicks, but if you really want to see the difference between how the media is spinning something, I think this is an interesting exercise, by the way. If you really want to see the difference between how the media is spinning a story versus how they put it out there as a press release, go to their website, mormonleaks.io. And on there, you'll see their press room. And when you go to their press room, you'll see in order, chronological order from most recent to past, the documents that they've put out to the press or for press availability. And usually they'll have a title and there'll be some sort of a scant description beneath it, and then the links to the documents themselves. The description itself, I skimmed through a couple of pages and I found that most of them were just descriptive in nature. Just these are the documents that we have with no commentary, nothing from the guys at Mormon Leaks. However, there were a few times when they put in further commentary in there because they knew that the media tended to twist this stuff out of proportion. For example, the Trump story that we're going to get to, if you go and visit how that was laid out on their website, you'll see that they put in quite a bit of information about Mormon practices of baptism for the dead, making it clear that this does not necessarily convert those people to Mormonism, that it gives them the opportunity to accept it. That's what we believe in the afterlife. They made that pretty clear in how they framed this to the media. Now, did Newsweek run it that way?
Not from what we saw. So here's the other thing too. There is a part of me that I get where you're going with that. You know, we're always feeding the media machine, and you're going to see a lot of that. And it's not just a Mormon issue; it's everywhere. But I think Mormonism includes this extra level of emotion because of everything within our culture and everything, including the consistent push and pull between believers and ex-believers or non-believers, however you want to describe them, right? And I don't know how that a group like them, because when you phrase it that way, and again, this is, I think we should be fully transparent, Brian, in the interest of transparency. This is a conversation that we've been having with them nonstop over the past week. It's actually been a really exciting and interesting conversation, despite the fact that I leave for some meetings and then I come back and I've got 200 messages between all three of you guys. I don't know how you resolve some of those issues, though, simply for the fact of there's transparency. And then there's transparency with an agenda. And it doesn't matter where you're coming from on that, on any spectrum, people are always going to view you with an agenda somehow, some way. And I think the only way that a group like that could resolve some of those lingering concerns or questions, because you're never going to make everyone better, is potentially if you were to get some believers involved with that, to be able to offset it a little bit, to be able to have some more, how would I phrase it, neutral language, to be able to have an objective outside look. Now, there's going to be problems with that. Problem number one, are any believers going to want to be involved in a situation or an institution like that? And I'm talking your traditional believers. And then problem number two is going to be, okay, so whose agenda are we going to run with? So why are we going to release this?
You're saying that they need an editor?
I think so. I might know an editor.
Right. Hey, listen.
I know you got all this free time, right?
Anyway, well, I want to move on from this, but I just wanted to just kind of clear up my blow up from last week. I have to admit that I came from a position of ignorance on how things work with them, how they put things up, how they feed things to the media. And I'm going to be honest, I'm going to fall on my sword and say I never actually visited their website. And the reason for that was because I never wanted to give them the clicks because I had a negative view of them. So I didn't want to get in there and look at the bad guys, right? Yep. But I'm glad that I did, because now I can see exactly how they put things up. Now, you know, again, as we've talked to them, so this won't come as a surprise, my biggest recommendations are be more discriminating in the stories than they are, because it becomes a boy who cried wolf situation where eventually people just, you know, stop paying attention to you altogether. I don't think that it's helping the church become any more transparent by putting everything out there. Stick to the stories that really matter, in my opinion. Number two, make sure that you're framing things in a way that at least when the media goes out and does its thing and spins it for clicks, at least you're in the clear, because at least you gave it a solid attempt of saying, look, I put it out as fairly as possible and they took it and ran with it in another direction, but at least we could compare that side by side.
I mean, right. If anything, you did your due diligence, and then you could, in essence, you could claim, I don't want to say claim ignorance, but you can claim innocence and say, look, this is what we wrote. This is what the media did. I don't have any control over how headlines are written or however they're going to want to spin this or however. This is what we got. So. Yeah.
So we've got a lot to get to today, and we're going to have to move on from this, but I hope that kind of helps our audience kind of understand our position on this and some of the looking into it that we've done this week. Now, before we move into getting into the news, we got an interesting letter that I want to read from Lois Lawrence. And it's not a nice letter, but I wanted to take the opportunity to thank Lois for writing us, because, you know, whether it's critical, whether you guys think that we're awesome, I mean, hey, we're not for everybody. right?
We're not, and we're not above criticism and critique. And I'm used to, I'm used to nasty Graham. So it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, Lois is a Patreon subscriber. And so we want to make sure that we give Lois, a few minutes to make sure that her voice is heard.
Right. Absolutely. And we appreciate your support on Patreon. I don't know if she's going to continue supporting us after I respond to her letter, but hopefully in the interest of open dialogue, she'll see where we're coming from on this. She said, not nice disparaging President Trump on your show. Are you even aware that he's taking no salary for his job? So you stating that he would be getting into the coin return to steal change is asinine. Okay, Lois, I'm going to stop there and just quickly respond to that and just say it was a poor taste joke. It's all it was. It was a joke. You know,
I don't have a lot of high humor.
I mean, it was funny. And I'm sorry that that you took that seriously. We're not saying that he's going to go out there and steal coins. It was just something that it wasn't scripted. Right. It was just something that came to Brandt's mind right then. He was laughing about it. I asked him what he was laughing about and he said it. So yeah, we're sorry. Okay. She said, are you aware that Utah's electoral vote was far more for Trump than for Hillary and helped him get elected? And yes, I'm very aware of that, Lois. And it bothers me. It crushes my heart to know that Utah was one of the outliers for Trump during the primaries. And that even the church-owned newspaper, Deseret News, asked Trump to resign from the presidential campaign. We made it clear from the church's standpoint that they didn't like the things that he was saying on immigration in particular. So Mormons weren't really that comfortable with Trump up until the election when they went into the voting polls and decided that they hated Hillary more.
Once that curtain was closed behind them.
Yeah.
But you know what, though, Brian? That's something that happened across the country. I mean, that
it did.
Every poll was saying that it was going to be neck and neck or Hillary was a little bit ahead. And then the curtains closed. And that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And so what bothers me in this whole thing is that the reason that Trump took Utah is because Utah really hated Hillary, not because they loved Trump. I mean, I think that's just a fact. So I think that we caved. And I think that that's actually mud in our face. I'm gonna say that. I mean, so continue with her letter. He is our president, whether you like it or not. He is the POTUS, and have a little respect. Yes, I recognize that he's the president of the United States of America. I'm not one of those who says not my president. He is my president. He is the president of our country and our nation. No, I don't like the guy. I think, in my opinion, he's in my lifetime, which I've been born since the Carter administration. That's how far back.
I thought you were going to say the Civil War, Brian.
Yeah, the Civil War. Sometimes I feel that way. But no, I was born in the Carter. Ford. I was born the year Gerald Ford became president.
How far back do we want to go, Brian?
right.
Actually, Nixon. No, it was Nixon.
It was actually Nixon. No. But so I'm still fairly young. But in my lifetime, he's the worst president I've seen. And he's an embarrassment to the White House, in my opinion. Right. I wish that we had a president with a higher moral standard. Have a little respect. I respect the office of the president. I'm not going to respect him as an individual in the presidency. And I'm sorry about that. That's just the way that it is. I would hate to see the world if Hillary had won. I don't think we need to play that game, Lois, of it's still playing on at least he's better than Hillary. Well, Hillary's way out of the picture. Now we're dealing with Trump in office doing what he's doing. And I'm not happy with what he's doing. Then you continued and said, I would much better have seen Romney win, but he didn't. Now, Romney obviously didn't even run, so there was no possibility of him winning, but I get your point. And I think that I'm on the same page. I would have rather Romney as well.
Keep your eyes out for 2020 or 2024. Like,
yeah, we'll see what happens.
The hill that I'm going to stake my flag in. Just keep your eyes out.
And incidentally, Romney isn't the biggest cheerleader behind Trump either, if you haven't noticed. He's setting himself up in opposition to Donald Trump. So I don't think it's crazy. Right? Okay. So here we are then she switches topics and says, I also think that your show borders on being anti-Mormon. Having the Mormon Leaks people on and you're groveling with them about the term gaslighting was sickening. The founder of Mormon Leaks went to the temple and videotaped the ceremonies. Why didn't you ask him about that? He had a temple recommend and lied to get in. What a jerk. Okay. That's the end of her letter. First of all, you're absolutely wrong. That was not Mormon Leaks that went into the temple and taped the ceremonies. That's a completely different person, completely different individual, not related at all to Ryan McKnight or Ethan Dodge.
And I don't think we want to mention the individual who went into the temple and has released all the temple recording videos.
No. And we have, and Brant and I have zero respect for that guy. And we'll tell him that to his face. We would never invite him on the show. What he does is absolutely deplorable. And it's an offense to my beliefs, to the religion that I hold dear to. We're really trying not to be anti-Mormon, but if you listen to the show from last week, the reason that the Mormon Leaks people were on, Lois, was because we had called them out by name. Brant had called them out by name the week prior to that about their op-ed piece in the Salt Lake Tribune. We didn't invite them on because we were interested in discussing Mormon Leaks. We invited them on because we wanted to give them a chance to respond to us going off on them about the op-ed piece that they wrote to Salt Lake Tribune regarding gaslighting. Quite frankly, it just so happened to be that they were the Mormon Leaks guys. It could have been anybody that had published that op-ed piece in the Salt Lake Tribune. And if we'd have called them out by name, we would have invited them to come on to respond to us because we're trying to be adults about this. It just so happened to be that they're the Mormon Leaks guys. So
Salty Brian is salty today. Whoa.
Anyway, Lois, I get where you're coming from. I want you to continue giving us a chance if you will. If you won't, you won't. But, like I said, we're not for everybody. But we really do try to be fair and balanced and look at both sides of things and to give things give people and ideas an opportunity to speak for themselves. And speaking of opportunities.
Hold on. Fair and balanced. I think I've heard that before.
Okay. You're not comparing us to Fox News now, are you?
I don't.
Listen, speaking of opportunities, Brant, tomorrow is the last day of Greg Cofford Books' annual 12 Days of Cofford Sale, where they offer great deals on Mormon scholarship. You've got today and you've got tomorrow left. Now, tomorrow, get this. It's going to be an ebook flash sale on Kindle. Okay, so you're going to have to go to it, and this will be only for Kindle exclusively. They're going to put out 12 titles for $1.99 for most of them. There's a couple of them that are a little higher, but most of them are $1.99. And I'll give you a teaser on two that I think that everybody should download. Brian and Laura Hale's Joseph Smith Polygamy, Toward a Better Understanding, and Nylon McBain's Women at Church. You're familiar with that book.
Both of those are $1.99 each?
They're both $1.99 each for one day only.
Are you guys trying to go bankrupt? Because everyone's going to be buying those. Like, I can't believe you guys are offering those books for that cheap. Those books are like at least twice, worth twice as much.
Well, yeah, twice, three times, four times. But we're doing it because we've done this traditionally on December 12th on the last day of our 12 days of Christmas, kind of giving this big final push to it and giving people a really, really good deal to get their hands on the content. It's not making us any money, but it's giving people an opportunity to get some books that they've wanted to have for a long time. So here's what you need to do tomorrow morning on December 12th. Greg Cofer Books is going to post on their Facebook and Twitter pages a link to the 12 books that they're offering the sale on. Again, it's good for one day only. So follow them at facebook.com/GKBooks or on twitter.com/GKBooks. Let's get on with the news.
Okay, Brian, let's get into it. This one is first from the Salt Lake Tribune. Pressure builds for BYU to scrap its beard ban.
I'm not going
to
complain about this one, Brant.
I figured you wouldn't. But if it does, don't expect the Mormon school to become a haven for the unshaven. Hey-ho, someone, headliner, gets their bonus this week. So here's an interesting one. This has been a discussion that we seem to have every 3 to 5 years. Oh, hey, let's go back to the beard ban. Let me give you a little bit of background. In 1971, Dallin H. Oaks, then BYU's president, and now a senior Mormon apostle, told students that rules against beard and long hair are contemporary and pragmatic. They are responsive to conditions and attitudes in our own society at this particular point in time and are subject to change. This is back in 1971. I would be surprised if they were not changed at some time in the future. Okay, so that was 1971. Now it's 2017. There are three categories for beard exemptions because the BYU, the school still has the beard ban in place. The three exemptions are medical, theatrical, or religious. So, for example, if you are part of a non-LDS religion that requires you to have a beard, you can have that one. If you're in a play or some sort of a film that's being filmed, you can get an exemption there. Or medical. And I know quite a few people who've had the medical beard card exemption. So the attitudes are changing. And Brian, here's something that I've seen, at least personally in my corporate environment. My corporate environment is fairly conservative. I'm seeing more and more people with beards, and they're mostly young people. And so I think what you're going to see is probably in the next 20 years, this will get overturned. There's no doubt in my mind, mostly because the beards now aren't – they're not as gross as people think they are. And I think the more and more you're seeing younger people, at least in positions of power in conservative corporate environments, have beers, the more that we're seeing them, for example, on television, the more people are going to be comfortable with that. And I think it's inevitably going to change with BYU, unless BYU and the LDS church and everyone in between goes back to the easy fallback of tradition, because that's all we seem to know is, oh, it's always been traditional that we've never had this, except wait, this tradition started in 1971. And
right.
And so, I don't know, Brian, it's one of those where it's like, okay, it's every 3 to 5 years, it's time to have this story again, but it's like, okay, all right, well, we'll see what happens.
I think we're edging closer there. You know, so I was talking to somebody down at BYU, and they said that they had these things set up to kind of take the pulse on students as to what they felt about the beard ban. One of them was, I think it was like a big, I don't want to say it was like styrofoam or some big head, basically, yeah. Right? And then the other one was a box. And then they had all these like cotton balls, right? And so the students could take the cotton ball and they could decide whether to throw it in the empty box saying, no, I don't want beards. Mm-hmm. Or they could pin it on somewhere on the big giant head.
So right. They're put the cotton balls are going to be pieces of beer that they're putting on it, right?
Right, right. Exactly. So about a week later, they went back and visited this box and the entire head was just covered with cotton balls. And inside the box, there was maybe like two.
Yeah.
Cotton balls. So, I mean, you know, that's a scientific survey if I've ever heard of one.
Brian, that's about as scientific as the survey that I did using a Google form. So,
hey. So I think it's, you know, I think that the times they are a change, and let's just say that. So let's move on here. Speaking of times that they are a change, and let's talk about the next Mormon survey stuff.
And so speaking of surveys, so this is a survey that's been done by Benjamin Knoll and Jana Reese. And what they've been doing is they've been trying to find out what's going to be happening with Mormons in the future. So looking at people probably younger than even my demographic, Brian. So they asked, they've been releasing little bits and nuggets here and there along the way. And I think that they're not going to get fully released until like 2018, maybe even 2019. Either way. So they asked each self-identified Mormon respondent to answer the following question. Which statement comes closest to your own views, even if none is exactly right? Okay, so this is a question about their belief in the LDS Church. 49.1% said that I believe wholeheartedly in all the teachings of the LDS Church. 33.9% said I believe many or most of the teachings of the LDS Church. 12.2% said some of the teachings of the LDS Church are hard for me to believe. 3.1% said many or most of the teachings of the LDS Church are hard for me to believe, and 1.8% said, I do not believe in the teachings of the LDS Church. So some interesting information. Brian, probably something that I don't think people are too surprised at. I think some of the language that they're using is relatively interesting. It's something that I think people can discuss. What does that mean? What does that mean if you're responding to it in that way? But here's a couple of other nuggets that came out. Among Mormons who said they attend church at least once a week, which was 74% of all Mormons in the survey, 9% of that 74 expressed some degree of doubt. Among those who say they are very active, 55% of all Mormons, 6% expressed a degree of doubt. Even among those who are current Temple Recommend holders, 4% expressed at least a degree of doubt in LDS Church teachings. So, Brian, doubt is really trendy right now. I actually just had a conversation with someone in my home ward about the whole concept of doubt and how I don't know if doubt's the best language that we should be using to describe some of that. But it's a survey result where I'm sitting here saying that's not too different from what I thought. If I'm just doing some quick math on the back of the scratch pad here, it looks like about 84% said they either believe in all or most of the teachings of the LDS Church. That's not too surprising. But I also think that it's, you're starting to see that believe in many or most of the teachings of the LDS Church, that cohort is seeming to grow, especially among younger Mormons.
Yeah. I think that the survey results, if they're surprising at all, I think it should be surprising to those who assume that there's this massive disaffection going on within the LDS Church right now. And we see that when we see groups online, they tend to, because their group numbers tend to grow to, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 people in their group, they tend to assume that they're representative. Yep. Of what's happening within the LDS Church. And I think that this kind of shows that by and large, most Mormons still believe. Right.
Yeah. And I think that was kind of the joke that they used was that line from the Book of Mormon musical, a Mormon just believes. They're kind of there. But I do think that what is interesting, and I will say this from the outset, I know that Jana and Benjamin have actually come under a lot of fire because of people that aren't, they're seeing the results of the survey going, well, I'd want to know who they're talking to. And I know from talking to Jana specifically, they made a very conscientious and deliberate effort to make sure that the individuals that they were, I'm losing the language to describe surveys, but their survey group, what am I trying to say, Brian? The people that they surveyed, they tried to make sure it was a representative sample. So not a self-selected sample of, for example, disaffected Mormons or not completely and totally ultra-progressive Mormons, but a large smattering of people. And so it's interesting to see that. But I also wonder, Brian, if this is something that is not unique to the LDS faith and if this is something that we're seeing more and more with people in general. They're much more comfortable with a degree of vaguity or a degree of not absolutism in any of their beliefs, whether it's religion, whether it's politics, whether it's social issues. There are some always going to be the hardliners on there. But I don't know. I work a lot with the youth and I see them being a lot more comfortable with, well, maybe this, maybe that. I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it all out.
Sorry, I had myself on mute.
Welcome to live radio, Brian.
Welcome to seeing how the sausage is made behind the scenes here, folks. I'm sitting here talking away and my mic is on mute. But, you know, since we do have quite a bit more to get to, I really didn't have anything more interesting to add to that one other than just acknowledging the fact that it's really not that big of a surprise. Now, I do think it's interesting, though, that there is some growth in the people who say, well, you know, there are some things that I just really have a hard time believing, but I believe most of what the church teaches. That group seems to be growing.
Before we move on, I will say this, though. I would think that once the survey results are officially out, and so not that we're seeing all these little snippets from Benjamin and Janet, but once this is out, I would say that anybody, whether you are a parent of younger children who are Mormon, or if you work with younger Mormons, whether in the youth or with the young single adults, this is a survey that you should read and you should be thinking about and trying to figure out, does this apply to my group? Because I think there's going to be a lot of good information there. Just understanding who are the Mormons that are going to be running and leading the church in the next 50 to 100 years.
Right. So why don't we get into Trump's visit?
Oh, boy. So the Donald came to Utah. Oh, Brian, this was a joyous and wonderful week.
What did I say last week when he came? I said I was just hoping for the right photo op. We're going to get to that in a second. That's a spoiler. It's a teaser.
Is that a great photo? Okay, so the president made a few statements at LDS Welfare Square. It was very brief. And what he said was, I would love to, while the media is here, just to say a couple of words of what we just discussed. All the care and all the giving that you've done, and to help people, in particular poor people, would be a good thing. Perhaps they will transmit that to different parts of this country and the world. It's so brilliant to hear. So President Irene was there, and he said, thank you, Mr. President. We're here in a place where you have food and materials that we give to the poor. This is simply an example of what we do across the world. The idea being that we think we have an obligation to God to look out for the people who, without our aid, have tragedy in their lives, be it poverty or hunger. I mean, I was amazed at how many news outlets picked up on President Trump going to Welfare Square, going inside the welfare store, being with President Eyring and President Nelson and Bishop Cosse, and I think there was one more there. President Bingham, Sister Bingham from the Relief Society. It was really interesting to see, like, those pictures were plastered everywhere.
Okay, are we ready for the photo?
Okay.
This is the photo. This is the photo. No, I did the funny one. So here we go.
Okay.
Can you see that photo?
I can see it. So if you're watching us on video, there is a great picture of both President Trump and President Nelson there. They don't have the best looks on their faces. They look they don't look too happy. But it is a picture of the two of them standing next to each other, and someone has photoshopped a huge T-shirt that says "Our Get Along Shirt."
So those who are listening to us on audio, I'm sorry that you don't get to see the picture, but you know, we will have this up on our Patreon page as well as YouTube and Facebook. So if you want to go in and, you know, even fast forward to where we're at now just to see the photo, you welcome to do that. But so I had asked you know, a couple of some feedback on the photo, and it was the one without the T-shirt on them. And we got a little bit of funny remarks on that. So do you want to just highlight a couple of those?
Sure. So one of them, again, this is a picture of both President Trump and President Nelson. They're standing there. They don't is probably just an unfortunate photo time to take it, but they don't have the best looks on their face. And so one of the comments was President Nelson saying, "Are you done yet?" And no, you're not getting a candy bar on this trip. Another one was President Trump saying, "So wait, why can't these people just go get a job from the job store?" President Nelson, "We talked about this, Mr. President. That isn't a thing." President Trump, "Well, they should pull themselves up by their bootstraps." President Nelson, "Mr. President, these people are doing as much as they possibly can, and we feel a Christian imperative to help them." President Trump, "Well, I just don't get it. I'm a self-made man. I didn't need this." President Nelson, "President Eyring, don't you have something else you want to show the president?"
The next one, "Sir, I think you have more than 12 items in your cart."
I mean, he does. I mean, if we're all, listen, we Mormons, if anything, we're all about rules. So 12 items is 12 items. Another one, "Donald, you know we can't afford the fun pack. What, do you think money grows on trees in this family? Take it back."
Oh, that was a good one. I think that was that. Was that you?
That was me, yeah.
Oh, that was good. That was good. Okay, next one. "Is it really necessary to make funeral potatoes?"
Is all this really necessary?
Oh, is all, yeah. Is all, oh, you're right. I butchered that one. Let me do it again. Is all of this, all these ingredients in the cart, really necessary to make funeral potatoes? All right.
And Brian, we know the answer.
Yes, of course.
The answer is of course, right? Okay, and then the last one. "How much is a bag of pasta? Like $45? That's an Arrested Development reference for all of you. Anyways, check out the picture. It's good. Brian was just giddy this week because we got that picture.
I was really hoping for the, you know, obviously not happy to be there. And, you know, Brant, it wouldn't surprise me if they had to draw straws to, you know, who was going to meet with President Trump from the quorum. They're humans, and I have a feeling that a few of them probably don't like Trump either. So.
Probably not. So anyway, so speaking of Donald Trump this week, Brian, oh boy, we referenced this in the beginning, but there was some more news this week about Donald Trump and the Mormons. This is from Newsweek. "Mormons baptized Donald Trump's parents and grandparents after they died," Mormon leaks revealed. "Members of the Mormon Church posthumously baptized President Donald Trump's parents and grandparents, according to leaked documents from the whistleblowing organization Mormon Leaks, which aims to expose corruption in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. According to the documents on the Mormon Leaks website, the Mormon Church baptized Trump's grandfather, Friedrich, who died in 1918, and his grandmother, Elizabeth Mary Christ, who died in 1966, in 2015 and 2016. Trump's parents, Marianne McLeod and Frederick Christ Trump, were also baptized, but the ordinances were not made available to the public. According to McKnight, it's likely the church's top leadership is unaware that Trump's relatives have been baptized. Quote, the names that are submitted are done at a very low level in the church. That is very unlikely that the institution had any knowledge or say in the process, McKnight said. And I don't think that Ryan's wrong. I think that that's true. A lot of these, Brian, you know, because I don't know if you and I have covered this in the past, but this has been a story within Mormonism for the past 20 or 30 years, going all the way back to Holocaust victims back in the mid-90s, being baptized in the LDS Church posthumously through baptisms for the dead. But I don't know if it's a Mormon-wide conspiracy the way that Newsweek was making it out to be. And I think this is what you were referencing when it came to a lot of the different media outlets taking the story and running with it.
Right. I think that this is a great example of looking how Newsweek framed this versus how it was pitched from Mormon Leaks on their press release, and you'll see a pretty wide disparity. Now, there were other news organizations. This got covered by a lot of news organizations. There were others that were more fair in their coverage. I think KSL did a pretty decent job of covering this and sticking fairly closely to the type of framing that was offered to them. You know, I think that really what it comes down to here is that this is one of those things where it's like, is it really any surprise, right? I mean, that some member of the church who was a supporter of Trump's would think that they're doing the Trump family a favor by baptizing them. But it does reveal, I think, that we still have this issue in the church where we're baptizing people without necessarily obtaining permission and maybe not being personally related to them. And that brings us back to what you said about the Holocaust survivors and Holocaust victims, rather, the Holocaust victims that were being baptized by the church. And and we, you know, rightly got mud on our faces over that practice. But the problem is that it hasn't really stopped, right? So there aren't enough checks and balances in place to make it really stop. So I think that what Mormon Leaks saw in this, and again, I'm not trying to be too defensive over them, but what Mormon Leaks saw in this was an opportunity to say, look, there are still these baptisms happening that probably shouldn't be happening. And you know, maybe we need to open up the church's baptism records for inspection by non-members of the church. I don't know. What do you think?
Or even put a more stringent process in place for people who are going to be submitting names. Because if I were to find a shred of how I could defend this, granted, this is part of the information that we don't know, and I'm not trying to claim anyone's right or wrong in this situation. But for example, could it be a relative of Trump that's connected through a fourth cousin twice removed who just happened to be doing their genealogy and did that? Personally, I don't think that happened. I think that's a big problem that we've had in the church and that we've seen happen time and time again, which is Mormons that are going out and trying to, I don't know how to describe it, like celebrity baptize, do celebrity posthumous baptisms for people. And I think it's wrong. And but the problem is, unless you put a much more stringent process in place as far as vetting and validating some of this stuff, I don't know if it's ever going to be fixed. I do think, though, yeah, we should be aware of it. And I don't think that the LDS Church would be too happy, especially if you could find out names of who actually did this, to go to them and say, why are you doing this? Like, stop. They're not, it's not your role to do this. You don't have any relation to them, so therefore, you should not be doing this. Whether it's going to happen or not, I don't know. I think that the only way that's going to happen, I don't know. They got a lot of mud on their face with the Holocaust victims back in the mid-90s. You figured that would have done things, and I know that they issued letters and things like that. But we saw it again with President Obama. Now we're seeing it with President Trump. I'm sure you could go back to everybody. I know that Adolf Hitler, this has happened in the past with him. So it's like, okay, where do we go with it? I don't know.
Right. So we have a lot of political news to cover this week. So we're just gonna kind of plow right through this.
Oh boy! All right. So okay. First off, let's just get this out of the way. Mitt Romney's in the news a lot, and Steve Bannon's in the news a lot. So everyone, buckle up. It's actually been a while since we've talked about our old friend Mitt Mittens Romney, and I've missed him, Brian. I don't know about you. It's like, hey, I forget having you in the news like every time I wake up in the morning.
I always enjoy seeing him in the news, if nothing else, because he still has that haircut. He still's got that square jaw. He's got the perfect teeth. And, you know, it's always just nice to see him smile and, yeah, maybe throw a few jabs at the Trump administration.
There you go. Okay, so this is coming from Fairhope, Atlanta. Or I'm sorry, Fairhope, Alabama. Former White House political strategist Stephen K. Bannon, and this is, again, coming from the Washington Post, rallied for Republican Senate nominee Roy Moore by picking another fight with a figure from the so-called Republican establishment, 2012 GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney. Judge Roy Moore has more honor and integrity in that pinky finger than your entire family has in his whole DNA, Bannon said in his 30-minute speech at Oak Hollow Farm. By the way, Mitt, while we're on the subject of honor and integrity, you avoided service, brother. Mitt, here's how it is, brother. The college deferments, we can debate that, but you hid behind your religion. You went to France to be a missionary while guys were dying in rice paddies in Vietnam. Do not talk to me about honor and integrity, he said, referencing Romney's Mormon faith. So, Brian, first of all, before we get into some of the other stuff going on here, I'm always questioning someone who overuses the phrase brother, okay? So that should be a big red flag there. If you've got someone that's like, hey, brother, let me tell you how it's going to be, brother. Okay, my spidey sense is tingling just a little bit. But our old pal Russell Stevenson actually made a really good point that I don't even think Bannon considered when he was getting into some of this stuff regarding mission, draft deferments and military service deferments and missionaries. So he said, quick PSA in the dust up over Bannon's remarks regarding Romney's military service. Seriously, this kind of conversation is so old, almost as old as the Republic. A little mythology is taking hold. The draft was in place during Romney's missionary service, but it had a different form than 1969. Until 1969, the draft was run by draft boards who selected individual names collected through the Selective Service Administration. To redress the highly politicized and sometimes corrupt nature of the draft boards, the Romney the lottery system was implemented in 1969, making the selection process more randomized and less susceptible to political influence. So there's a lot of things that are going on here. Here's another comment from Mel Tungate. Bannon is wrong, by the way. Mitt and I are the same age, 4 months apart, and we both went on our Mormon missions about the same time. 1965, war, not much. 23,000 U.S. men in Vietnam. Mitt had a student deferment and was attending Stanford. 1966, the war starts heating up. Now you have 190,000 in Vietnam at the beginning of the year when Mitt applies for his mission. If he hadn't gone on a mission, he would have went back to Stanford and gotten another deferment. Mitt gets a student deferment, then minister exemption mid-year. 1968, Mitt returns at the end of the year, goes back to school at BYU. He would have had a student deferment by the end of the year, almost 550,000 in Vietnam. In 1969, there was a student deferment. And then December 1st, 1969, the draft lottery, Mitt's number was 300. The highest number called up that year was not 195. The war was slowing down, but not yet over. And then in early 1973, the draft was ended. So this is kind of a crazy situation, Brian. And it's something that was actually surprising because a lot of people got really defensive about Mitt Romney, and frankly, rightfully so, because I think I'm looking at Bannon's comments going, buddy, you are someone who I don't think you understand how that whole draft process worked. Look, I'm really young, and I had to go through a lot of their commentary, a lot of both Russell and Mel's commentary to figure out what exactly was happening. I'm actually trying to work my way through the, the guy who did the Civil War, Ken Burns, the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam. That's actually helping to put some context behind it, but it just felt so cheap. So here's another story, because Brian, you said we're going to blast through this, right?
Yeah, let's just keep moving.
This is from the Salt Lake Tribune. Hatch, Herbert, and other Mormon observers blast Bannon's attack on Romney's LDS faith as disappointing and unjustified. Okay, so now Orrin Hatch has inserted himself between the Bannon, Romney, and Roy Moore, because Bannon was at a Roy Moore rally, and Romney had been critical of Roy Moore, considering some of the stuff that's gone on with Roy Moore's sexual past. On Monday, the Washington Examiner reported that Hatch said he didn't think President Trump had any other option than to endorse the GOP Alabama Senate candidate who had been accused by multiple women of sexual misconduct. I don't think he had any choice but to do that. That's the only Republican we can get down there, Hatch said, according to the Press Pool report. He also noted many things he allegedly did were decades ago. So that's Orrin Hatch's opinion on Roy Moore. Well, we got to have him because that's the only Republican we can get down there. And yet this week, Hatch went after Bannon. After Bannon blasted Mittens at a Roy Moore rally. Brian, are you keeping up with all this? Because, like,
I'm trying. I've got charts. I've got graphs. I'm connecting red lines through.
I was just going to say, we're getting to that point where it's like we're starting to get conspiracy theory. So here's what Hatch said. Steve Bannon's attacks on Governor Romney and his service are disappointing and unjustified. Mitt is a close personal friend, an honest leader, a great American, and someone who has sought every opportunity possible to serve our country. I also resent anyone attacking any person's religious views, but particularly our own Christian LDS faith and the selfless service of missionary work, Hatch continued. I'd be more than happy to sit down with Mr. Bannon and help him understand more about the LDS Church at his convenience. I've got a copy of the Book of Mormon with his name on it.
Ooh. So he does a missionary invite. You know, and maybe that's the way to take this. Maybe Bannon needs to learn a little bit more about the Mormon faith and religion. Maybe we ought to sign him up for a missionary delivery of the Book of Mormon over to his house. And, you know, maybe he can compare that against some other religions. We can also sign him up for the Jehovah's Witnesses to bring by their material. He'll have them until the millennium.
You know what, Brian? You know what I was thinking? You know what would be great? If all of our listeners decide to send a Book of Mormon over to Mr. Bannon's house and the missionaries, could you imagine how much different he would feel about the LDS people if he were inundated with Books of Mormon with his name on it?
It would show him so much love.
Right. And a couple of fresh-faced missionaries who are like, Mr. Bannon, we just like to share you our message. How could you not love that? Anyway. So speaking of, so we had that whole little, you know, I don't know if I call it a love triangle. It was more like a love square. We're getting to a love octagon now, right? Okay, so let's keep talking about Orrin Hatch. This is from the Washington Post. If Senator Orrin Hatch won't retire, Mitt Romney should shove him aside.
Okay. You know, but hold on, but it wouldn't take much of a shove. I mean, the guy's what, like 85 years old now?
I mean, not that we're advocating for any physical interaction with anybody who's an octogenarian, but okay, here's what Rick Wilson at the Washington Post said. Love him or hate him, I'm admittedly in the first camp. Mitt Romney is a gentleman. That's why he's waiting patiently for senior Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, in office more than 40 years, to decide on retirement before jumping into the 2018 Utah Senate race. It's admirable. It's also time for Romney to shove Hatch aside. Wait a minute, I thought we just talked about that. We don't shove 80-year-olds. And Utah is a perfect fit for him. He's been out of the spotlight. But he's as well known as any Republican politician. Like Hatch, he'd be a Mormon running in a strongly Mormon state. Unlike Hatch, who has become just another reliable Republican vote, Romney's evident distaste for the current administration is something in sorely short supply among Republicans in Congress. I don't think Rick wrote this for people reading it like me. I've spent limited time in Utah in my career, but when I've been there, I've been struck every day by Utah's decency, work ethic, common sense, and in particular, compassion for others. The state's unique demographics, culture, and politics makes it a fascinating laboratory for conservatism, and Utah is conservatism without the constant sense of grievance that marks the Trump-era GOP, plus Fry Sauce is a national treasure. I mean, Brian, if this guy is looking for the Utah vote, he's got it right there.
Did he write that in there? Plus, Fry Sauce is a national treasure. Did you add?
No, he totally wrote that in there.
He wrote that in there. That's great. So, I mean, just a comment on that. I think, nothing would give me more pleasure, even though Utah was part of the Electoral College that put Mr. Trump into office. It would give me nothing but pleasure to see the Utah Republicans become the de facto alternative to the alt-right craziness that's going on in the GOP right now.
So speaking of that, there is some interesting stuff coming out of the Salt Lake Tribune. This is George Pyle, how Romney could be the beginning of the end for the Republicans. So there's something interesting going on in Utah. They've got their traditional parties, but Utah is also this weird microcosm for different political parties to crop up. Evan McMullen cropped up in there and actually had a decent amount of votes in the 2016 presidential election. But here's the interesting thing. There is a United Utah Party, UUP, and they are courting Mitt Romney really hard. So this is from George Pyle. Here's how it can get a lot more interesting. Romney could accept an invitation presented in these pages on Friday. Richard Davis, chairman of the fledgling Utah United Party, proposed that Romney seek the Senate seat as a UUP candidate, eschewing the whole of the Republican ecosphere as irreparably tainted by the president. Bannon accused mall walking creep Roy Moore and various other crypto Nazis and race baiters. Hatch, according to some polls, is finally wearing out his welcome among Utah voters after more than 40 years in office, enough so that he might be actually vulnerable to Salt Lake County Democrat Jenny Wilson. So, Brian, he's advocating for maybe Romney jumps into the third party, but I don't know. I mean, interesting stuff's going on in Utah right now.
So I've been following this UUP, this Utah United Party. I actually signed up for their email list because I know Richard Davis personally. He's a political science professor down at BYU. He's an author. He wrote a fantastic book called The Liberal Soul that I would highly recommend. And he's politically pretty moderate. And this book, this party is definitely trying to shift the conservatives back to more of a centric position from where it seems to be at this point. And I really think they have some good, they've outlined some pretty good points, some pretty good platforms. Now, I don't know that that Romney's going to go third party. If he did, he would probably get Utah's vote still, just because of who he is, right? I don't know that he would do it. I don't know how loyal he feels to the Republican Party, or if he feels at this point the Republican Party is pretty much lost its way and it needs to go. I think, so the Republican Party has been in power since a little bit before the Civil War. It was about 1857 when it was first organized, and it was really kind of a conglomerate. Here's your history lesson, folks. It was really kind of a conglomerate between a few parties that preceded it, such as the Whigs and the Free Soilers and other groups that supported its causes that were all pretty, at the time, pretty progressive causes, such as abolition of slavery, right? And they would debate about how to do that. The Whigs were one of the largest parties of its day, and they were really created in response to Andrew Jackson. Jackson was the founder of the Democratic Party, and that was in the 1829, 1830, right? And the Whigs came about shortly thereafter as a rejection of Jackson and Jackson's Democratic Party, right? So eventually they merge into what's called, the Republican Party in 1857. Incidentally, I think it's interesting to note that both slavery and polygamy were part of their original party platform. So Mormons, Mormons were being targeted by Republicans at the very beginning there. Oh, the irony. It's very interesting. But at any rate, we get this notion, and I know I'm birdwalking all over the place. Let me bring this back. We get this notion that these parties are the only two options that we have and that they've been around forever. And when you look at America's history, I mean, yeah, they've been around the longest. There's no question. They've been around now since Civil War and pre-Civil War days. But there's really no reason why we should only have these two political parties, right?
That, yes, and I know that that's something that people have been advocating for a long time, and I think that the only way that's going to happen, I actually thought that we were probably closest with Ron Paul in 2008, maybe even 2012. It's just not the case. So I don't see Mitt Romney being that passionate about third parties to be able to jump on there.
Unless his distaste for the Republican Party continues to grow based on the direction that it's going. So rather than trying to fix the Republican Party or trying to bring it back to a little more of a rational center position, maybe he's going to say it's time to just abandon the party altogether. I doubt it.
I doubt it too, mostly because you'd have to have a decent, if you want to retain any sort of power and not just make this the hill you want to die on, you'd actually have to have a decent conglomerate to go with you. And maybe, hey, maybe that's the case. Maybe you've got people like Evan McMullen and Jeff Flake and maybe Mia Love and others, but I'm also sitting there going, not a lot of heavy hitters there other than Mitt Romney. And maybe that's all you need. I don't know.
I don't know, but we're getting closer to the elders of Zion saving our Constitution, aren't we?
You know, something on a white horse, Constitution hanging by a thread and stuff like that.
So speaking of Mormons, though, let's finish up this segment here with Jeff Flake, because he had an interesting week, too.
So Jeff Flake donated, so this is from thehill.com. Flake donates $100 to the Doug Jones campaign. So Doug Jones is the individual who's running against Roy Moore in Alabama. And in the memo line, wrote country over party. Flake on Tuesday tweeted a photo of a check he wrote for $100 to the Jones campaign, adding country over party in the memo line of the check and in the tweet. Jones is facing off against GOP candidate Roy Moore, who has been accused of sexual misconduct and assault by several women who say at the time they were in their teens and he was in their 30s. Flake, who announced he will not seek re-election in 2018, said that he would not support Moore before any of the sexual misconduct allegations came to light based on Moore's past comments that Muslims should not be able to serve in Congress. Brian, that's an actual thing. I looked into this.
Yeah.
In October of this year, Flake came out against Moore based on a 2006 column Moore wrote where he said that, quote, Muslims can't swear to uphold the United States Constitution and still be a Muslim because the law of Allah as expressed in the Quran is supreme.
These are the same complaints that were being lobbed against Catholics and the Pope, and then same thing that was being lobbed against the Mormons with having a prophet. It's the same thing.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Romney had to give that influential 2008 address because of all these things, because of things that were happening. So that's what he went on to add. So this is Moore. Moore went on to add that Islamic law is, quote, simply incompatible with our law. He went on to compare taking the oath of office on a Quran with allowing an oath of office to be taken with Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf in 1943 or Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto during the Cold War. So that is
that's just unbelievable.
Jeff Flake is very strong against Roy Moore. And I believe, Brian, the Alabama special election is on December 12th. And it sounded like Roy Moore didn't have a chance. And then I want to say last week, the polls were showing that Roy Moore is starting to pull ahead because...
Well, as soon as the GOP started backing him again, and as soon as Trump expressed his backing and support for him as well, then you're right, the tide started shifting for him.
And frankly, as soon as people started forgetting a lot of these things. And so it'll be really interesting to see what happens over the next...
That's how the news works, doesn't it? It's fickle and it's something shiny distracts your attention.
We know better than anyone. All right, so the last story of this week. Brian, wow, it's been a big show today. This is from stgeorgeutah.com. Former Mormon bishop asked church leaders to stop interviewing kids about sex behind closed doors, petition at 5,000 signatures and growing.
That's a pretty big signature petition.
It's something that catches my attention, I'll put it that way. Sam Young, a former bishop in the LDS Church, has started a petition to stop the practice of one-on-one interviews between Mormon leaders and children. The petition has garnered over 5,000 signatures. The petition states closed-door meetings between adult men and children that include questions pertaining to sexual matters are inappropriate and may serve to shame children. Young led a drive for the petition near the church-owned Temple Square in Salt Lake City Friday and Saturday. Even if it isn't a church policy to ask questions about sexuality, Young is calling for an end to the practice of closed-door interviews that a child's parent may not be aware of. The church's public affairs department declined to comment on the petition when asked by St. George News on Monday. While he doesn't know whether the church will acknowledge the petition, Young said it has already accomplished a major goal of bringing awareness to the subject and promoting healing to those who have shared their childhood experiences. Brian, this is a story that is actually 5,000 signatures is a lot, and especially with something that people can be so sensitive about regarding LDS bishops and interviews behind closed doors, especially when it comes to sexual matters. Wow, 5,000 is not a little bit.
It's something that I think should be seriously weighed and considered, at least. And, you know, I have to say this. I actually brought this story up with my wife this week, and she immediately said, oh, I would sign that petition. And my wife is somebody who never gets involved with anything that's of a scandalous nature at all when it comes to the church. She said, oh, yeah, I would sign that petition. And the reason is because she's also had pretty uncomfortable questions be asked of her when she was in her young teen years. By her own bishop behind closed doors. And she remembers how uncomfortable it made her feel and how it made her feel kind of devalued and started questioning her own worthiness of being able to engage in the church. And, you know, so I got to imagine this, and that's anecdotal, of course, but I got to imagine that that it's not an isolated thing. One more comment on this. I serve in the primary, and, you know, in the primary, you always have to have two teachers, you know, at the same time. I serve with another brother in the church, and, you know, we serve together and we teach CTR 5. And if one of us isn't there, we need to either find somebody to fill in, or we need to send our class with another class that does have two teachers. I mean, that's how strict this policy is for primary teachers to be in a room alone with children, right? This is something that I don't think should be that controversial, that we have a policy that extends all the way across the board for any church leader, much less a church leader who does have the privilege of hearing confessions and digging into very personal matters. What are your thoughts?
So, okay. So I'm with you. I actually think that, and I don't know if it's a matter of just covering Mormon news for the past four or five, however long I've been doing this. When I was doing the news report, we always had a section that was the Mormons behaving badly. And I always used to get people really mad at me. Why are you including this in there? You're just making the church look bad. And the point was, I was including it in there because we can't get too comfortable with a lot of these things. Stuff happens. On the whole, and I think you and I have talked about this before, Brian, on the whole, 999,999 bishops are going to be good, upstanding men who would never even think about any of this stuff. But then there's that one. And so the question is, what do we do about that one? Because in my mind, that's the one that we should be focused on. So it's interesting. I've had this discussion with a few people, and some people are like your wife. They say, yeah, I've had experiences in the past, and yeah, it really affected me. Some people are very adamant that no, we can't do that. Bishops are supposed to be judges in Zion, and how can you be a judge in Zion if someone else is going to be in the room with you? And that's the bishop is the only one who can hear that. But I think the problem is, and I've actually seen this a lot within Mormonism, we're not very good at being creative within Mormonism. On the one hand, we're going to hold up like what you're doing with the primary. That's a good example of a good way that we could be accomplishing this thing. On the other hand, how do you begin to navigate the fact that the only person that, at least within our current LDS structure, that an individual can confess any sort of sins to is an ecclesiastical leader like a bishop or even a state president? For me personally, I would love to give the Relief Society presidents a lot more latitude to be able to hear some of those things and maybe not serve as a judge in Zion, but serve as sort of a facilitator somehow, some way. Because I can't even imagine what it would be like for a woman to talk to a man about a sexual issue, and if that would be a little different if it's a woman talking to a woman. Additionally, I don't think it's a secret that I serve with the youth. I don't think we should be looking at men to women. It should be men to everybody, right? And I really think that what we should be doing is we should be opening the door so that if a bishop is going to be interviewing an individual, there is someone else in the room. That could be a member of the bishopric. That could be a member of the young men's presidency, an elders' quorum president, a high priest group leader. If it's a woman, it could be a member of the primary presidency, of the young women's or Relief Society presidency. There's so much room for us to be able to work with some of these things. And I just know that from talking to some people, they are more comfortable sometimes with certain individuals than others. And I'm not saying that what I'm saying is let's get creative about this. I don't think we can stick our head in the sand and say it doesn't happen. It does happen. And while we can sit there and say, well, that was just an isolated incident, I don't care. The fact is that's an isolated incident that now someone is dealing with and someone has to, that's part of their life. And while it didn't happen to you, how would you feel if you were the isolated incident and everyone was pointing at you saying, well, you're the isolated incident. So I'm actually, I know Sam a little bit. I think that this is a worthwhile cause. It'll be interesting to see if it garners any attention. It'll be interesting to see what other individuals out there determine that they want to associate with him and if that's going to prevent or if that's going to contribute to any additional exposure. But I do think it's a discussion that we should be having because I don't think we're having it because we rely too much on, well, we rely too much on tradition.
I think it would be an interesting question to throw out to our audience.
Ooh, that would be a good one.
Let's do it.
So what do we got, Brian? How are we going to phrase the question? So,
well, let's just keep it simple. Should bishops be interviewing kids behind closed doors?
And we want to hear all kinds of opinions and thoughts because we're not afraid to throw it all out there. So you can hit us up, mail@mormonnewsreport.com. You can find us on Twitter at The Mormon News, or look us up on Facebook, Mormon News Report, and let us know your thoughts, because we're intrigued to see if either way, where you side. And we'll be right back with Fiona Givens. So you've heard us talk about Patreon for like forever, right? And I know, here's yet another hand extended out for your hard-earned cash. But this time, it's different. See, you're already interested in some of the finer things in life. You know, like your weekly dose of Mormon news with a sprinkling of snark that brings out all the wonderful subtle flavors of entertainment in a very weird world. You are a refined individual, a diamond in the rough. Dare I say, Brian, a pearl of great price. So why don't we add to that a little bit? As a Patreon subscriber to the Mormon News Report Extended Sessions, we spend a few extra minutes with our guests getting to the meat of the questions you really want to know. We turn the lights down low, we loosen our neckties, and we kick on the slow jams to really get down to business. If you're interested, just visit patreon.com/Mormon News Report. That's patreon.com/Mormon News Report, and become a subscriber today. Folks, it's only a dollar. That's less than the price of a cup of, that's right, we don't drink coffee. That's less than the price than a cup of maybe a Big Gulp from 7-Eleven. We'd like to welcome onto the show Fiona Givens. Fiona was born in Nairobi, Kenya, educated in a British convent school, and converted to the LDS Church in Frankfurt, Germany. And oh boy, do I have stories about finding Gumi Barchin in Frankfurt, and it changed my life. I'm not kidding you. She graduated from the University of Richmond with degrees in French and German and received a master's in European history. She has worked in translation services as a lobbyist, as a communications director for a nonprofit organization, and is an author. She has co-authored 3 books with her husband, Terrell: The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life, and The Crucible of Doubt, Reflections on the Quest for Faith, and most recently, The Christ Who Heals, How God Restored the Truth That Saved Us. Thank you for coming on the show, Fiona. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on the show.
Well, I am so glad to have you. So this is the third book that you've written with your husband, and all three have been some marvelously theologically rich and deep books. I mean, they're the types of books where I seem to have to read a couple of sentences or a paragraph and kind of put the book down and just kind of mull on it for a little bit.
So do we. We have to do the same thing. Mull on it. We write a sentence or two, and then we mull as well.
So it's good to know that we're kind of in the same boat. Like, okay, this is, and it's good to know. I'll say this: it's good to know that that's kind of the way it is. Where it's a book where you pick it up, you chew on it, you put it down, and I think it makes for a very enriching read, no matter how much time you have. But if I could be superficial, just a bit. So I'm looking at all three of these books on my bookshelf right now, and they almost seem to be a trilogy. They've got the same font on the covers. They've got the same cover style. They all fit nicely with each other. The titles are even similar. Was that the original intent when you guys were writing these books?
No. The original intent actually was just to write the one, The God Who Weeps. We had absolutely no conception of writing any other books. And then The Crucible of Doubt came, I think, when we were realizing that there were many members of the church who were really struggling with historical and theological issues, cultural issues and theological issues combined within the church. And this actually stemmed from a family member who was having a real struggle with his faith. And we were going over the issues that he had raised and also the issues that we were struggling with ourselves. So there's a lot of Terrell and myself in these books. They are generally generated from questions that we have, our friends have, or things with which we are struggling. So that's how Crucible of Doubt came out. And then so it's not really a trilogy. The covers make it seem so, but The Christ Who Heals really is a spin-off of The God Who Weeps, because we recognize that with the redirection of the nature of God, then something was contaminated in the relationship between the Father and the Son, and the role of the Son, actually, particularly in the Protestant tradition, not in the early Eastern Christian tradition, was changed. So God the Father became wrathful, vengeful God with Augustine, but then it was exacerbated by the contributions of Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli to this wrathful, vengeful annihilator, punisher, and Christ became the shield, our shield and defender, and so they were working at cross purposes. And we realized that we really needed to write a book on the Christ, that this was a plain and precious thing that had really been lost, and that it was absolutely essential. So that's where that came from. So the trilogy, I think, would be we've formulated, we've written the two books, is one on God the Father, one on God the Son, and then one on God the Holy Spirit. Mm. So the title for the next book is the God who sanctifies, or the Spirit who sanctifies. Mm. I like the alliteration, but that will be down the road a little while.
Well, you just answered my next question of what was down the road for this. If you're looking for a fourth trilogy, or if you want to, you know, consider changing the scope of the third one, I was hoping for The Mother Who Comforts.
Yes. And I have to say, when I talk to women in the church, particularly when there is this discussion that revolves around Gethsemane and Christ entering the garden and asking for this burden to be alleviated, which of course it can't be, and it's not a rhetorical question, take this cup from me. He's looking into the abyss, and theoretically it was fine, but now he's actually in it, and the whole horror of it is no longer theoretical, it's real, and he's staggering away from the abyss. And so we always assume that when he is saying, nevertheless not my will but thine be done, that this is just an obedience phrase. It's not. It's Christ giving God another room to move, to answer the question, to answer his plea in another way. And God does. I mean, he obviously cannot take the cup. The fate of billions and billions of people hang on this precise moment in history. But he does say that the scriptures do attest that an angel is sent to comfort the Savior and hold him and help him through this or unfathomable ordeal. And LDS women with whom I speak unanimously say that the angel had to have been the mother.
I really like that idea.
That's I do too. And Fiona, it's interesting that you bring that up, and Brian, that you bring up that question. That was something that you and I were talking about throughout the week as far as this book. It was really surprising very early on in the book how many references there were to heavenly parents. And I'm thinking of a little bit of research that we did around General Conference time, where we looked at the BYU General Conference corpus to see how many times heavenly parents have been mentioned. And if you look at every decade from back in like the 1840s or 50s, it's gone up over the last 10, 20 years. And I think it's really powerful that we're starting to see more and more literature like that, because I think it is more encompassing. So was that intentional, that you decided to include deliberate references and acknowledgments to divine heavenly parents within your book?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Erastus Snow said that, I think this is in the book, mm-hmm. that God comprises male and female, man and woman. And Elder Ballard, who said that it was heavenly parents who presented the idea or the proposition of a more abundant life, that we were intelligences or spirits. Joseph used the words interchangeably, that we are coexistent with God, but the question was, do you wish to have more light and truth? Mm. And we assented, but the emphasis is, and I think this is really important in our theology, that there is the male and the female deity. And it is incredibly encouraging to see that heavenly parents are being mentioned more and more in General Conference. But yes, it was deliberate. It's important for us to be able to embrace the fact that this is a familial collaborative effort. So we could say, really, this is our work and our glory to bring to pass the eternal life and immortality of man. It's a collaborative familial effort.
So I don't want to detract from the Christ who heals, but this reminds me what you're saying of a recent chapter that you contributed to an anthology, Perspectives on Mormon Theology Apologetics. And it was titled The Perfect Union of Man and Woman, Reclamation and Collaboration in Joseph Smith's Theology Making. I think that was loosely based or refined from a dialogue article that you published.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So, yes, that's correct. So it seems that in the chapter, you're arguing for what you are doing in The Christ Who Heals, where this discussion of the male-female collaboration of the divine God is a necessary component of our conversation, right?
Absolutely. I think as soon as I think Joseph, by sundering the Godhead from the corset into which it had been confined for, you know, centuries, releasing the three members of the Godhead into highly individuated gods, did two things. One, he destroyed the idea of sovereign and destroyed the idea of hierarchy and pulled into the conversation councils. So once you have three or more people, you have a council, and it's rather like, King Arthur and the Round Table. There is a collaborative element. There's no hierarchy, no sovereign, no top dog. It's everybody working collaboratively. And Joseph's primary work was to this idea of creating a Zion, where we have a completely collaborative membership. There are no poor among them, no physically, psychologically, emotionally poor. All things were in common. And I think what he's saying is that there is this egalitarian society where people are looking after each other. I think we see that most specifically in the baptismal covenant that we make, this idea that Christ is inviting us into a familial relationship when we take our name upon us. So Mormons, Terrell and I strongly believe, are the emphasis in baptism is not on the remission of sins, as it is an adoption into the family of God. And we are adopted through the baptismal covenants in Christ's sole purpose, which is to heal. So the three covenants are to carry burdens. And we do think there is actually evidence that in the early church, people before they were baptized actually articulated these covenants. And I wished it would come back because they're so incredibly powerful. You know, I covenant with you that I will carry your burdens. I covenant with you that I will mourn with you when you mourn. I covenant with you that I will comfort you when you stand in need of comfort. And what is so extraordinary, unfortunately, this occurred to me after the book had been submitted, but all three members of the Godhead are present. So we have the God who weeps, wherefore should the heavens not weep, seeing that these my children shall suffer. They are called perdition. Why? Because the heavens wept over them. He identifies himself as man of holiness. So this is God the Father in both Enoch 7 and in Jacob 5.
My favorite passages in all of Latter-day Saint scripture, by the way.
Which are?
The Book of Moses.
Is it not absolutely stunning?
It's stunning theology. Yeah.
Oh, I absolutely agree. It's just brilliant. This is like the pearl of greatest price. Anyway, so, you know, so the God who mourns is that God in Enoch. And then the God who carries our burdens into Gethsemane and then onto the cross is, of course, the Christ. And then the God who comforts is the Holy Spirit. So the whole familial Godhead is there. So we are invited. It's the most fabulous thing. We always think of Saviors on Mount Zion as vicarious ordinances for those who are deceased. And that is beautiful. But this is a living thing into which we have been invited to participate. And of course, it's not just members of our community. All mankind is part of divinity. I love that differentiation. Man of holiness is my name. My son is called the Son of Man, and we are called mankind, the God-like, all of us, all of humanity. So it's not just to our individual communities, but the covenant is made at baptism to help relieve and comfort and offer solace to everyone who comes within in our purview.
And if I could, you know, your discussion on covenants. So that's one of the things that I think that the baptismal covenant is something I think that we as LDS people know, and we know it on a on a very basic level, but I think the way that you're phrasing it, like if we actually physically go through a covenanting process where we are stating the things that we are covenanting in a verbal way, potentially even in a public way, I wonder if that would just make it sink in more, because there's so many things that I think about. And look, I don't mean this to get down too much on our Mormon brothers and sisters, but at the same time, that I'm sitting here thinking to myself, guys, maybe if we actually say the covenant, it might mean a little bit more, and we might take it a little more seriously, that when we say we're going to mourn with those that mourn and comfort those that stand in need of comfort. I say this because it's a sore spot for me, because it's actually something that I got in some arguments in my ward about. That means when we're talking about people like refugees, people that don't look like us, like, and I wonder if that reaction would be different if we went through almost I don't want to say a ceremonial, but a religious type process where we are acknowledging these covenants and saying them out loud. And so you have to internalize them and think about what you're saying.
No, Brent, I think you are absolutely right. There is something about articulating something aloud. Words are powerful, but they're much more powerful when they are articulated aloud. And so, you know, I was baptized at 19, and I constantly hear this reference to the covenants I made at baptism. I do not remember making any covenants at baptism. Yeah. I didn't. There were no covenants that I spoke. And I think you're absolutely right. There is a power there. There becomes suddenly this awareness of a community out there that is mankind, refugees, people who don't look like us. But you're absolutely right. Articulating this aloud, and I wish it would come back, makes it that much more powerful, that much more personal. And the idea that you have covenanted now. So you can't offer platitudes anymore. There's no superficial way of responding to great pain when you are articulating a covenant to walk in the pain and the suffering with which your fellow member or fellow member of mankind is walking. I absolutely agree with you, Brent.
So let me ask you this. So in the introduction, you write, however, in our emphasis on the particularities of the restoration, a boy prophet, gold plate, seer stones, and restored priesthood, we too often pass over our faith in Christ, thinking of it as a commonly shared Christian belief that deserves little more than comment. So it seems like we struggle with this within the church. I just on a personal level, I remember about 5 years ago, I was asked to teach a lesson in Elders Quorum. And the lesson was on tithing, right? Didn't think anything of it until I was sitting in second hour Sunday school, because I actually did, like, look, credit to me, okay? I actually did prepare the lesson before church, right? So I'm sitting there in Sunday school, kind of looking over some notes and trying to figure out, okay, how do I want this lesson to go? And I look at a calendar and I realize, it's the Sunday before Christmas. What am I doing teaching a lesson on tithing the Sunday before Christmas? I should be teaching a Christ-centered lesson. And so it's one of those things where that jumped out at me, because the whole book seems to be getting back to the focus that Latter-day Saints should have on Christ. And we do, but sometimes these appendages seem to work themselves in. So am I the only, and I guess I'll toss this out both to you, Fiona, and to you, Brian. Am I the only one that noticed this? And is this something we Mormons should be better at?
I'll make a quick comment and then I'll turn it to Fiona, because she'll have a much better response than me. So I'm a fan of the Christian liturgical calendar, and I wish that we had a way of incorporating that into our church. I understand why we don't, but I wish that we could at least incorporate elements of it, because I think that if you look at even Jewish tradition and their feasts and their holy days and the things that were set up to remind them, these remembrances that they have, I feel like we as Latter-day Saints are sometimes forget that. We have lost track of some of those things. Now, we have a reminder every week through our sacrament ordinance, and we have our temple attendance and things like that to remind us of our covenants as we're serving somebody else, which is great. But sometimes I think that we could have at least church lessons that were more directed towards significant events that we should be reminded of.
Yeah, I would be quite happy if we just included Christmas and Easter on our calendar.
Yeah, we can start there, right?
Yeah, if we started there, that would be fabulous. But I do remember attending, and I think it might at Sunday. Christmas might have fallen on that on a Sunday, and the whole thing was on Joseph Smith and his birthday. And then Easter, it's we would just fly by. It's so funny because we make fun of these, you know, Easter and Christmas Christians. They only come on Easter Sunday, but there is more worship there than there is for us. So for me, I think it would be absolutely delightful. And I mean, it might mess up the calendar, but I think we could handle that is, you know, skip the Sunday before Christmas and then have a worship service on Christmas Day. How beautiful would that be to have a service of lessons and carols? Just beautiful.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Wouldn't that be beautiful? And the same thing on Easter Sunday. You know, if conference is on Easter weekend, move it, you know, and let's celebrate Easter. How wonderful again would that be? Just no other meetings, just this beautiful, again, lessons and songs about the resurrection. It would be just an hour and a half. It would be true worship. We would be incorporating Christ into our community, into our liturgy, and in a way, I'm afraid we do not. And that was really part of the reason for this book, is that if our version of the Savior is not radically different from the rest of the Christian world, then what are we really bringing to the table? And that really was the question that was the genesis and the stimulant for this book. And we found it, quite frankly, in the early Greek theology. Mormon theology is much has much more resonance with the early Christian fathers than it has with anything in the West. This idea of theosis, this idea of pre-existence, but this idea particularly of Christ coming to heal a wounded humanity. That mortality wasn't a punishment. Mortality was educative, and passions come with it. It's such a huge shift. Elder Renland spoke about it, I think, in the spring conference, this idea of Christ coming to heal his diseased sheep. So our theology is more about, for the Greeks, it's death and resurrection. For us, it's woundedness. We see this all through the restoration scriptures, woundedness and healing, and a shift, whereas in the West, it's always sin and salvation. And those were primarily introduced by Augustine and then exacerbated by the reformers. So our traditions are very, very different. So we're trying to recapitulate what we feel Joseph was trying to do in the early days of the church, was bring back this much more magnanimous and optimistic view of both God and humankind.
That was something that really stood out to me in reading your book, was this notion that we've tried to Protestantize Christ. And it makes sense, because that's the tradition that we grew out of, or even the Western, you know, tradition in general. I found it interesting that so much was placed on Augustine, and this kind of Augustine's, I need to say, theological switch, because at one point he did hold some of these views and then moved away from them, right? And it seems like from that point forward, the whole Western world just sort of followed suit, which I thought was really quite interesting. I love Roman Catholic liturgy. I know you grew up with it. I've attended a few Orthodox, like Greek Orthodox services, and I've always been enamored with them, but I've never really given as much depth of thought of their early church fathers as much as I have the Western church fathers. Yeah. So for me, this was a huge education, and I appreciated just the beginning of the book, just the side-by-side charts that you had of early church fathers and, you know, kind of what their theological grounding was and what days they live. That really, I think, helped set the tone for the book as an educational tool.
Thank you. And it was for me. I have spent almost 2 years buried in the early church fathers, and it was the most magnificent, joyful experience. Just hearing this radical resonance between early Christianity, which started in the East. We tend to forget that because we're so absorbed with the West, but is so radically resonant with Mormon theology, and not at all with Western theology, but you're right, the church was birthed in a very Puritan Protestant America, and yet what does Joseph do? He immediately goes Catholic. He restores sacraments and more to them. He restores priesthood, mm-hmm. and he restores the link between the living and the dead, which is quite extraordinary. But then I think he goes further, considerably further. He goes with theosis, which the Western Christian world simply will not accept, this idea that man can actually become like God.
And I've got to ask, because it's a major part of everything, but it is a lot of what Joseph is trying to do with his theology, is a lot of that a sticking point at that point in time because it is so radically different? Or, I mean, put into context some of what Joseph was trying to do with America in the 1820s and 30s.
No, it's interesting. The general tenor is, as you said, Protestant Puritan America, but there are universalists also. There is a sort of a shift in religious sensibilities away from this view of this harsh, vengeful, terrifying God to somebody who has to be more gentle and more kind. And quite frankly, I think it was that which prompted Joseph to go before this God, you know, the idea that he wouldn't be rebuked. I mean, I think he hung on to that verse, that promise. It's like, maybe he won't shout at me if he shows up and won't rebuke me. I really do think he entered that grove with some fear and trepidation because that God was so paramount. But as I was saying, there is this also this swing towards something, a God who is more benevolent, more merciful. And I think that was one of the largest attractions about Mormonism, pulling in from the Methodists, who had a much more gentle and a more optimistic view of both God and mankind. But also, Joseph was doing radical things that were not accepted by the early community. I mean, he talked about you know, the saints who would give up everything, walk for thousands of miles and shatter to pieces like glass whenever he was trying to introduce something new. So it was a tentative thing he was trying to do. I think he was really trying to burst through the paradigms, but his constituents wouldn't allow him to burst through them. They were so stuck in the traditions of their fathers. And I think we are too. Quite frankly, I think Mormons are, we have adopted too many of the Protestant traditions of our fathers. So there is a heavy emphasis on words like sin, words like judgment, words like perfection that have a purgative meaning in Mormonism. When to save, being saved from our sins, when we actually go back to the Greek text, and of course there's an agenda behind translations. There was definitely an agenda behind the King James Version. I mean, we've got James the First, who is the daughter, the son of the very Catholic Mary Queen of Scots, and he himself is a Catholic, but he's in Protestant England and trying to let everybody know, no, I'm really Protestant. So there was an agenda in that King James Version. And so we have this focus on sin and salvation when in the Greek, the word most often used for salvation is sozo, which means to heal. And so once you shift this from, you know, a premise, a paradigm of sin and salvation to woundedness and healing, suddenly people have more room to breathe. And just from looking at Joseph's sermons and the DNC itself, you know, the whole temple liturgy for Joseph is formed around the tragic death of his brother Alvin, by which he was so severely impacted. His parents said he never recovered from that. He's going through section 76, the terrestrial kingdom, the honorable men of the earth, the honorable men and women who hadn't had the opportunity to receive the testimony of Christ, but later did. And Alvin wasn't baptized. So that's where Alvin was. And then a few years later, he is absolutely astounded to see Alvin in the celestial kingdom. And for him, that was the genesis for the temple endowment, this idea that there is progression. He saw Alvin progress from a terrestrial world when he should have, in the Protestant tradition, been in hell. But he's in the terrestrial world, and then he sees that he has moved into the celestial kingdom. And when we look at the development of the liturgy within the temple endowment, that is exactly what is happening. Everybody is moving up. So it's the most generous view of atonement theory.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on, Fiona. We really do appreciate it. Do you have a few minutes to stick around for a few more questions for our Patreon subscribers?
Absolutely, I'd be delighted.
Wonderful. You can find The Christ Who Heals, How God Restored the Truth That Saves Us from Deseret Book in both physical book form, if you like the smell of the pages and the feel of the pages and all that stuff, or ebook copy, as well as Amazon, Benchmark Books, Pioneer Books, and other Mormon book retailers. And now for your Moment in History, brought to you by our friends at todayinmormonhistory.com. 110 years ago this week, on December 7th, 1907, Charles W. Nibley became presiding bishop and began implementing several financial changes, including a shift to an all-cash policy in collecting tithing. So, Brian, your chickens are not worth anything anymore. You get those eggs out of here.
No, you go sell those eggs and you bring us the 10% that you've earned off of the sales of those eggs. We don't want the chicken. And, you know, to be fair, the chickens were making a mess.
Listen, the one thing that they don't account into your one out of every 10 chickens going to the bishop's storehouse is someone's going to have to clean that. So unless you're here cleaning it, no, we don't want your chickens around here. And that is our show. We'd like to once again thank Fiona Givens for joining us. This show is brought to you by the Cultural Hall Podcast. Be sure to check out the rest of the shows available at theculturalhall.com. Music for today's show was provided by Scott Holmes, and Brian Whitney, you edited and produced today's show.
I did my best, but I think with this live format, there's only so much you can do for editing, so bear with us, folks.
Make me sound pretty, Brian.
That's right. Make me sound pretty. Hey, you know, and I want to thank those who have taken the time to give us an iTunes review. I think we're up to 12 now.
Mm-hmm. We are. We're getting there.
8 left to reach our goal of 20. Also, in case anyone is wondering, we currently have 13 of you listeners who are supporting us on Patreon, probably 12 or 11 after tonight's show. hopefully more. Hopefully Brant's pitch was hit you in the heart, right? And just woke something in you and said, I'm going to support them. I'm going to give them my $1 a month because I believe in what they're doing and because I want those extended sessions with their interview guests and I want to support them. But I just want to let you 13 patrons know we really do appreciate you. You get exclusive access to our video feed that we're going to put up. You get our extended interviews. And for the rest of you, please support the show. We'd like to go live on Facebook with our show. It costs a little bit of money if we went live to where we could get actual feedback. So help us hit that donation target, which is $55 a month to be exact, because we like to be transparent. And we're almost halfway there at this point. So if you'd like to see our show go live on Facebook, where you can actually comment while we're filming it, then please help us out by becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/Mormon News Report.
And as always, if you'd like to reach out to us directly, you can email us at mail@MormonNewsReport.com. As you can tell, we read everything that we get, and we appreciate every single email that we get. If you don't want it read on air, please make sure you put in the email, don't read this on air, because we think
it's important. Or your name, right? If you don't want your name read on air, then put in, don't use my name or something like that.
But we appreciate every single piece of feedback that we get. We'll be back next week. Next Sunday, Brian, it's our last show of the season, last show of the year, with more news, commentary, and interviews with a little bit of snark. Until then, we'll talk to you again after a while.